Hi, this is Little Anthony, Little Anthony Imperial, and you're listening to my good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Darling Love, and you're listening to my good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Ben E. King, and you're listening to my friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Peter Remigello, and you're listening to my good friend, Mike Miller, on the Harmony Street Show.
Hi, this is Mike Miller, and you're here with me on the Harmony Street Show, and it's my pleasure to have as my guest pop icon really good-looking guy and the toast of Southern Florida right now, Mr. Peter Lemangello. How you doing, Peter?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Thank you, Mike. That was a very nice introduction.
Let's just tell the truth. I mean, you were so hot when you came out, and you were so good-looking that... But I will tell you that not only did the girls like you, but the guys liked you too, because, you know, they really appreciated what you accomplished. We'll go back and talk about that, but I want to go back to the beginning. You were born where?
I was born in Jersey City.
Right, which, you know, we know Jersey City. My parents lived in Fort Lee for a while in transition, and, you know, but...
Actually, Jersey City's right next to Hoboken, and I was born in the same hospital that Sinatra Jr. and Nancy Sinatra were born in.
Oh, you know, that's fabulous. Well, I guess it was either in the air or in the water. But you did find your way to Long Island at one point. I know that.
I was 7 when we moved to Long Island. Yeah.
Well, you know.
The people in Jersey City thought we moved to a town called North Babylon, right next to a town called Deer Park.
I loved North Babylon. I had the house at St. James Infirmary for on and off for a whole bunch of years, and it was a great town.
When you were at St. James Infirmary,
right?
Was that owned by the Licatas?
St. James Infirmary was owned by Barry Lane, the midget.
Okay, all right.
When I was there. You know,
okay. That place opened up as a place called Bo Jess.
Yes, I remember that, and I remember when it was Cheers as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So we're neighbors.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember. I grew up actually in Manhasset Hills. You know, New Hyde Park, Manhasset Hills, that area. But I sang at every single Long Island club, and we can, at one point during this talk, we can go down the list, you know, but I sang at every club, and I'm talking about from Community Gardens all the way into Lakeville Manor, and then all the way out to the Hamptons, and the OBIs, and Rum Bottoms, and Cloud Nine, and, you know, yada, 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 on and on and on. And there will never be days like that again, ever, like there were in Long Island.
Well, I have to tell you that I happen to think that the era I grew up in,
right,
which we moved to North Babylon in 1954, I was 7 years old.
Gotcha.
I can't imagine a better place to grow up.
Uh-huh.
Our school was wonderful. The community was fat. We knew our neighbors. We had block parties. We helped each other build patios.
Right.
We didn't lock our doors or our cars.
Right.
It was just, I mean, every time a neighbor got a new car, the whole block came out to look at it. It was, you know, we were broke and nobody knew it.
Yeah. My first car was my 65 GTO. It was brand new.
And mine was a 60 Chevy Impala.
I mean, I bought some shitters before then, but my first one new was the GTO.
With a 348 engine and 3 2-barrel carburetors.
Yeah, I had 3 deuces on mine too. Yeah.
Which I got to tell you would blow any car today away. And it was just a time of so much fun and excitement.
Did you
without anything costing a lot of money? It was a miracle time.
Did you take it up to Islip?
Oh yes, Islip Speedway, absolutely.
Me too.
We even entered a car when I was a kid. I was a teenager.
Right.
A bunch of us entered a car in the demolition derby. We had more fun than we could ever describe.
I remember the demolition derby out there. We used to go out there. That was fabulous, man.
Those are priceless times we had. And again, nothing seemed to cost any money.
Oh, I know. I mean, and the clubs, I mean, there was a club, there was a great club and a great band on every single corner.
I know.
It was just, you know, it was fabulous. Cause I remember the Hassles, you know, singing at my house. I remember the Tiger Tail. I remember, hey, I got one for you. Remember Channel 80?
Yes. Yes, I do.
I found, I was going through an old wallet. I found my Channel 80 card. I said, people used to come up, you know, they drive there, but they would also come from the other end on their yachts and come, you know, like across the boardwalk there, you know, and go. And that was some place. I mean,
it's amazing to realize how much we have in common.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I remember Illusion, going to see them. I remember Rum Bottoms with Calhoun. I remember the Action House and hanging out there in Long Beach. And it was like, you know, you got in the car and you went. And I was singing with I had an a cappella group then that was signed to Relic Records. We were called the Islanders, and we had we did some cover records, but we would drive, let's say, to Long Beach or Oceanside. We'd get out of the car at Nathan's, and we'd just start singing, you know. And it was like, you'd draw a crowd, and the owner would come out, "Hey, Maguire Sisters, get out of here."
you know, I have to tell you that I meet a lot of singers who complain about bad breaks or how close they came, and they never got the break. And I was never that way, because I've always felt lucky.
Right.
And that carries from the first prom I went to. We went to a place called the San Susan in Mineola.
Noel.
And I said, someday I'm going to appear here. And sure enough, I did.
Wow.
And then my second prom, meaning when I took a girl that I was going out with who was a little younger than me.
Right.
We went to the Copacabana. And I said, and the excitement of just being at the Copacabana.
You
I said,
bet.
Someday I'm going to be here. And sure enough, I was.
And you did.
All the way to, I'm going to sit on that couch next to Johnny Carson, and I got to do that 25 times. So all I could say is I feel that everything I ever wanted to do, I accomplished.
Wow.
And so I can't tell you how lucky I feel.
Oh, absolutely. I always say, because, you know, I'll tell you, we discussed this one other time. I had an act with a guy by the name of Frankie Barry. They called him Frankie 13. He was a mafia brat. He was a Mulberry Street kid. And his father set up a showcase for us, and we did a Sandler and Young type of thing. And here we were, Sal Sicari's orchestra at the Copa, and, you know, oh my God, in jumpsuits, you know, like they're in the early 70s, you know, pinch me. But I wound up not going with him because I didn't want to be with the, Mike, come here, you know.
Yes, what, I know.
You know, and I ran away from it. And, you know, that could have been. But I always say in the things that I've done, because I've always been singing in one way or another, I'm happy to have been a tiny little grain of sand on a big, beautiful beach with all kinds of people, you know, some big seashells, some beautiful waves, some beautiful mermaids. But, you know, it's a big, beautiful beach. Just being a little grain of sand to me is like, hey, you know.
Well, it's nice that you're grateful, because I do a song in my act nowadays called The Impossible Dream.
Right.
And that's obviously the story about Don Quixote. And,
right.
Now, if you're from Long Island, you say Don Quixote. If you're from Greenwich Village, I guess you would say Don Quixote.
Right. There you go.
But if I said Don Quixote when I was in high school, they would have beaten me up.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean.
So, but the story is about a guy who was willing to fight for what he believed in,
right,
regardless of the odds.
Right.
And it's everybody's story, because especially if you're in show business, because the odds are incredibly great against you. And if you do fight for it, regardless of how much you get of it, it makes life worth it and perfect, because you were trying for something that you dreamed about. And I don't think anything is better than that.
To dream the impossible dream, to fight the unbeatable foe, to bear with unbearable sorrow, to run where the brave dare not go, oh, to right the unrightable wrong, to be better far than you are, to try when your arms are too weary, to reach the unreachable star. Oh, this is my quest, to follow that star, no matter how hopeless, no matter how far, to fight for the right without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know if I'll only be true to this glorious quest, that my heart will I peaceful and calm when I am laid to my rest? And the world will be better for this, that one man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage, yet to reach the unreachable star. And the world will be better for this. Oh, that one man, scorned and covered with scars, he still strove with his last ounce of courage, yet to reach the unreachable star. Better for this. Oh, that one man, scorned and covered with scars, he still strove with his last ounce of courage, yet to reach the unreachable.
Well, I started at Post, you know, and I was in my orientation class with Dick Heatherton, you know, Joey's brother. And, you know, it was like I flunked out my first year because we signed a contract with MGM Records and we were following the record. And when my father got that letter, he almost broke my head, you know, with a bat. And they sent him a letter, your son is no longer matriculated at this school. And I never knew that word, but then I learned it. And then so I said, Dad, I want money. I want to go in and record an album. And he says, I don't have money for that. Get your ass back in school, which I did. But I managed to sing on the side anyway. And, you know, it was all gratifying, you know.
Well, anytime you're doing something that you love, the gratification is immeasurable. There was a line that Bob Hope used to use when he said, when he closed the show, he said, people say I was made for this, nothing else would I trade for this, and to think I get paid for this.
Right.
You know, but the truth is, we're very lucky, both you and I, and anybody that's in show business, because what we do for a living, other people dream about.
Right.
And I don't think we could have been more blessed than that.
No, I hear you, you know, and I understand that. Let's go back to Peter. When you were young, and let's even go back to Jersey, your ear found certain things on the radio just like mine did. Who did you listen to when you were a kid? What did you gravitate
to
musically?
As I told you, I moved to Long Island when I was 7. So the people who were big, in those days, there was one kind of music. There was your hit parade.
Right.
And there was no rock and roll yet.
Right.
And the music wasn't segregated into different categories. So everybody listened to the same music, technically. So there was everybody from, Guy Mitchell.
Right.
Was having hit records. Eddie Fisher was having hit records.
Uh-huh.
Then, I'm trying to think of a few others, but the ones, Ed Sinatra, obviously.
Right.
The ones that influenced me are the ones I just mentioned.
Right.
But I didn't particularly think about their style.
Uh-huh.
I just thought about singing their songs because those are the only songs I knew at the time.
Right.
And Frankie Lane, believe it or not.
Oh, of course. I mean, Johnny Maestro always said that Frankie Lane was the first time he really appreciated, a good vocalist. You know, it was, he was watching TV and he was watching Frankie Lane and he said, wow, you know, that really lights me up when I hear that, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, he was a great, great singer, and I don't know why he chose to go to Australia by 1958 or 9.
Right.
And it kind of dropped out of our radar, but he made some incredible records.
Oh, absolutely he really did. So you're listening to mostly the standard stuff, and when did you realize at what age that you could get up and really sing a good song and have people go, wow, this
well,
guy could sing?
I'll tell you how it happened for me, and everybody gets encouraged in a different way.
Right.
In 1954, when I was 7, right before we moved to Long Island,
right,
my uncle got married. They had the wedding at the Brass Rail in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
And my father had heard me singing in the house. My mother was a terrific singer, but never aspired to do it.
Uh-huh.
She just happened to have a great voice.
Right.
And she used to play records and sing along with them and make me sing along with them.
Ah.
So I did a Frankie Lane song called I Believe.
Okay.
And my father wanted me to sing it at the wedding, and I was too scared. And he said, come on, if you don't have the guts to do it, you'll never do it. If you don't do it today, you'll never do it. Come on, you have to do it.
Right.
So I got up, and I got a reaction like you wouldn't believe.
Uh-huh.
And I think my head was turned from that point on.
Gotcha.
The problem for me, though, is that as I got older, as I became a teenager, I became a drummer.
Oh, okay.
And in those days, there were instrumental bands, so
right.
Nobody sang.
Right.
And, we played Duane Eddy songs and Santo and Johnny and things like that.
Been there.
Nobody sang. And when the Beatles happened in 1964,
right,
everybody turned into a singing group.
Exactly.
Before you know it, there were three microphones in front of every set.
Sam Ash made a fortune.
Right. And whether people could sing or not, every band, and I was in a band called the Bel Airs at the time.
Okay.
And we had to sing.
Right.
So naturally, everybody in the group says, well, who can sing? So I was the best singer of the four of us.
Wow. Drummers who sing, that's,
However, I was behind the drums, behind big cymbals,
right,
and three guitar players, and nobody ever saw me. And I was frustrated over that.
Yeah, that sucks.
which prompted me to want to disband playing drums and be a stand-up singer.
Yeah,
and I was doing pretty well. I was getting good reaction right up until I was 18. You know, I was sure I got out of high school. I started to pursue it.
Right.
And then I got drafted. I got drafted when I was 19.
Uh-huh.
In the 2 years that I was in the service, 1 year in America and 1 year in Vietnam,
right,
music changed so drastically.
You bet.
So when I came out of the Army in 1968, in the middle of 1968, protest songs were hot.
Ah.
You know, like Eve of Destruction and
right,
songs like that.
Right.
Well, and folk songs and all of the, and that's where the Beatles had hit and all of that, and Dave Clark Five.
Right.
And the whole British invasion. So I was actually not what the record companies wanted. And anytime I tried to audition for them, they said, wow, you're a terrific singer and you look good, but in effect, you're really a little too good looking. We're not looking for that today.
Right.
You know, things had really changed. And if it had been, 7 or 8 years earlier,
right,
I would have fit right in with the Frankie Avalons, and who's a good friend of mine, by the way.
Good.
And Bobby Rydell, who's another good friend. Huh. I would have fit perfectly into that group. But they were all, 8 or 9 years older than I am.
Right.
So I missed that. And by the time 68 rolled around, between 68 and 70, I really couldn't get anybody in the record business interested in me.
Right.
So I really floundered, except that I was becoming really good on stage.
Uh-huh.
And one night, I was playing the Rainbow Grill in Manhattan.
Know it well.
And there was a 65th floor of the NBC building. And the Tonight Show emanated from the 6th floor.
Uh-huh.
So I begged Fred DeCordova to come and see me.
Right,
I
and of course.
He said, Pete, Peter, we're inundated with people that want to get on the show. And I said, look, you come and see me. If you don't like me, I'll never bother you again.
When marimba rhythms start to play, dance with me, make me sway. Like a lazy ocean hugs the shore, hold me close, sway me more. Like a flower bending in the breeze, bend with me, sway with ease. When we dance you have a way with me, stay with me, sway with me. Other dancers may be on the floor, dear, but my eyes will see only you. Only you have that magic technique. When we sway I grow weak. I can hear the sound of violins long before it begins. Make me thrill as only you know how. Sway me smooth, sway me now. Other dancers may be on the floor, yeah, but my eyes will see only you. Only you have that magic technique. When we sway, I grow weak. I can hear the sound of violins long before it begins. Make me thrill as only you know how. Sway me smooth, sway me now. Dance with me, make me sway. Like a lazy ocean hugs the shore, hold me close, sway me more. Like a flower bending in the breeze, bend with me, sway with ease. When we dance you have a way with me, stay with me, sway with me.
That was a Monday night. He came to see me. After my third song, he gave me a high sign.
Wow.
That Wednesday, I did my first Tonight Show.
Wow. Tell the people who Fred the Cordova is, because I know, but they don't.
He was the producer of the Tonight Show for
right.
At least 20 years.
Right.
Great, great man. He loved talent. And I must tell you that it's a funny situation because the Tonight Show paid scale, $320.
Uh-huh.
As a result of that, if you were a member of ADVA, American Guild of Variety Artists,
right,
they had to audition you.
Oh.
So every Wednesday night they ran these auditions. And you would go, bring your piano player, do a song. If you're a comedian, you'd do a couple of minutes of comedy.
Right.
And Fred the Cordova would actually conduct these auditions. That's how much he loved talent. He used to like to look to see what was out there.
Wow.
Well, I auditioned 15 times. He never gave me a nod working with just the piano in a cold situation like an audition.
Right.
Is not very easy. It's not very easy to impress anybody.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, when he did put me on the show, I said, I don't understand. I auditioned so many times, and I did the same song every time I auditioned because I wanted him to remember it.
Right.
I figured at least he'd get familiar with it.
Right.
You know? And I said, what do you want me to do? Why now? He said, well, now that I saw you in a nightclub, he says, I think you're great.
Right.
He said, so you and the Doc Severinsen Orchestra are going to kill him. Uh-huh. I said, well, what do you want me to do? He said, do that song you used to do at the rehearsal. I said, I didn't think you liked it. He said, no, I liked it. show business is crazy that way.
But it had to be his idea. I mean, that's always the way they are. I mean, I've had that happen 100 times where you send a press kit or a promo or whatever, and you tell them, go look in, you know, you didn't send me anything. No, go look in your desk, and there were 5 promo packages there.
It doesn't mean a thing, and you know that.
Right, but when it's
got to be there, I get.
Exactly.
For example, I tried to get on the Mike Douglas show for years,
uh-huh.
And they kept saying no. I did one Tonight Show, and they called and booked me right away.
You bet.
And I said, my God, when we were doing the blocking for the lighting,
uh-huh.
During the rehearsal, where you have to stand on a white X,
right.
And they do all the lighting, and then they program it into a computer so that,
right.
Well, I don't really know if it was a computer in those days.
Yeah.
They program it so that when you come out, you know, in those days, we used to use every gimmick possible. I would come out and throw Mike Douglas a box of lemon jello, and he would hold it up for the audience.
Cool.
And doing the rehearsal, and while they were blocking the lighting, I'm saying to myself, now, what is that? I'm no better than I was when I auditioned. How come they put me on now? But
right.
The difference was, I had already proven myself. I'd been on The Tonight Show, and that made something out of it.
Oh, the shark bait has such teeth there, and it shows them pearly white. Just the jackknife has old Mahit bait, and it keeps it way out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Mackey, babe, so there's never a trace of red. Down the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just losing life. Someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Well, a cement bag just to tube it on down. That cement is just, it's there for the weight there. 5'll get you 10. Old Maggie's back in town. Now to hear about Louie Miller, he disappeared, babe, after drawing out all his hard-earned cash. And now Maggie's spent just like a sailor. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Said Jenny Diver, yes, he told me. Ooh, there's Lottie Lee and old Lucy Brown. Oh, the lifeboat's on the right, babe. Now that Maggie's back in town, said Jenny Diver.
Another question I wanted to ask you, I'm assuming you did all the Catskill situations, which I did years ago, the Pines, the Laurels, the Nemeson, the Neverly, the Windsor, the Browns, the
Concord,
exactly.
The Kutchers.
Yep.
Yeah, I did them all, and to be honest with you, I hated them.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why I hated it.
Uh-huh.
If you were an unknown to them, they didn't respect you at all.
Because they thought they knew it all, this crowd. I know.
Well, you know what it is? They were over-entertained. They're nice people, but they were over-entertained. They saw a comic and a singer every night.
You bet. Yep.
So you were either a boy singer or a girl singer, and everybody was technically doing the same material. Whatever was hot on Broadway, they were doing. You know, This Is My Life and My Way. And all the... So, pardon me.
Yeah.
You couldn't impress them if you lit yourself on fire.
I worked, them all. I worked, as a matter of fact, Ben Zucker was the band leader at the Windsor. I remember I worked with him a lot, But I also worked with every comic, and I'm talking about Morty Gunty and London Lee and Buddy, and, you know, I mean, and I knew all of their jokes. I don't remember them now, but I knew every joke. Shecky, I ran into Shecky in Fort Lauderdale. I was going to see a friend of mine, and I figured I'll go into a deli rather than raid his refrigerator. And I'm online, and I keep looking over my shoulder. I see this little old gray-haired guy, and I says, I know this guy. What the hell is this? And finally, I turn around, and I go, Shecky? And he goes, Green, why? And you know, we talked. We started talking. He says, yeah, Corbett Monica was my best friend, and blah, blah. I said, I always remembered your closing joke. He says, yeah, what was that? Tell me. I says, you know, you did the early show, and you're getting ready for the late show. You decide to go out onto the curb, you know, to have a cigarette. So you light up a cigarette, and all of a sudden, this big black limousine pulls out. 9 guys in tuxedos run out. They beat the shit out of you. They throw you to the ground. They're kicking you in the stomach, right? The cigarette rolls down into the pavement, and you watch it, and it's just rolling down. And all of a sudden, the cigarette stops. There were these 2 patent leather shoes. And you look up, and it's Sinatra. And he goes, okay, guys, that's enough. So that was Shecky Green's closing act all the time. And if you remember about Shecky, Shecky got into a little trouble with those guys because he owed a lot of gambling debts and all of that stuff. And they made him pay big time. So really, that joke had a lot of meaning because...
Yeah, because he said he used to open by saying, Sinatra saved my life.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Exactly right. Yeah, you know, yada, yada.
Every dance with the guy who gives you the eye, let him hold you tight. You can smile, every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget he's taking you home, and in his arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me. Oh, I know that the music's fine, like sparkling wine. Go and have your fun, laugh and sing. But while we're apart, don't give your heart to anyone. And don't forget who's taking you home, and in whose arms you're gonna be. So, darling, save the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so? Can't you feel it when we touch? I will never, never let you go. I love you oh so much. You can dance, go and carry on till the night is gone and it's time to go. If he asks, if you're all alone, can he walk you home? You must tell him no. Cause don't forget who's taking you home, and in his arms you're gonna be. So, darling, save the last dance for me. I know that the music is fine, like sparkling wine. Go and have your fun, laugh and sing. But while we're apart, don't give your heart to anyone. And don't forget who's taking you home, and in his arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me. Now don't forget who's taking you home, and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me. Ooh, baby, won't you save the last dance for me? You make the promise that you'll save the last dance for me. Save the last dance, the very last dance for me.
So the Catskills were fun and everything else. I remember you were talking about not being a big name. Remember Steve Alamo? Okay, he worked a lot in some of the hotels, and I remember he even had a record in the top 10 at that time. And, you know, it was like he had to do everything but do handstands and cartwheels in order to get people to, like, really...
Well, the good side of the Catskills was that it was a great training ground.
Right.
Because even though the audiences were tough as nails...
Right.
You really did get good training.
Oh, yeah, because you had... You had to get their attention, and you had a poke, right?
Yeah, nothing matches when I did Love 76, and I could sell out a Lincoln Center in 3 hours or Madison Square Garden or Carnegie Hall.
Right.
Nothing matches an audience who buys tickets, anticipates seeing you.
Right.
And can't wait for you to get on stage.
Right.
Because whatever you do, they're going to rave over, so that makes you 10 times better than you are.
Right, and you can really open up that way. Because,
and yeah. Instead of being inhibited,
right.
you really give them twice as much as you would if you were
right.
doubtful about how they're going to accept it.
Right.
So nothing matches that. And that's why there's a show business expression that everybody gets better once they make it.
But
the truth is, that the reason you get better is because of the acceptance factor.
Right. No,
again, you know, there's no question that that's a big psychological factor.
Right.
When the audience is, I mean, everybody's insecure. Everybody wonders, are they going to like me? And
right.
You know, all that. But when you're backstage and the comics on, and they announce the Peter Lemangelo show.
Right.
And 2,800 people scream.
Right.
Well, automatically your confidence level changes.
Yeah. It makes you want to run out there, not walk
out
there.
Exactly. You're not worried about whether they're going to like you or not. So it really does make you twice as good as you normally are.
Let's go back and say that here you are. You're singing and, you know, and you're getting paid to sing and whatever. I want to hear the story about how you came up with this concept to be marketed on TV, and I want to hear it from you because I've heard 100 people tell this story, and I want to get the right story for a change.
Okay, well, the truth is that I bump into people even today who tell me what I did as if they did it.
Right, gotcha.
And it's really comical because none of them have the slightest idea what I actually did. And what happened was, I opened for Don Rickles at the Copacabana. And I can't remember the guy's name, but the head of A&R from Epic Records was there.
Right.
And he flipped over me and he signed me. We did three sides, as the expression goes then, three records.
What'd you do?
I did the song called Mary Lee, which is a country song about a guy who bumps in a bar. He bumps into a girl who's a barroom girl, and it turns out to be his daughter.
Uh-huh.
It was a really good song.
Cool.
And I did Tonight My Love Tonight, which is a remake of a Paul Anka song.
Right.
And I forgot what the hell the other one was.
All right.
But anyway. And they didn't promote it, and it didn't happen, and I get dropped from Epic Records.
Right.
And now, it's even tougher to get a record contract, because once you've been with a major label and you get dropped.
Yeah.
So now, I become the opening act for Don Rickles for 2 years.
Wow.
So I'm making pretty good money. I'm working great places, packed every night. As you know, Rickles, the hottest thing in the world.
Yep.
But, I'm just doing an act, and they can't wait for me to get off because they're there to see Rickles.
Right.
So I can't get a record contract, and I'm only going to spend the rest of my life being an opening act.
Right.
So I'm home one night, and I'm watching a Crazy Eddie commercial.
Ah.
And I'm living a nice little Long Island.
Right.
And he says he has two stores. So I said to myself, hey, how can he be on TV if he only has two stores?
Fordham Road was one of them.
You know, this isn't Procter & Gamble here.
Right.
how can he be on TV?
Oh, when you think you're ready. Call down to Crazy Eddie, the man who's got most everything. A stereo sound, his audio selection. While he with your perfection, he's the man with all the lowest prices around. So come on down and put him to the test. See whose prices really are the best. Who fix you up with a sound of your face and guarantee a smile upon your face. When you think you're ready, call down to Crazy Eddie, the man who's got most everything, a stereo sound.
And so the story's told across the whole wide world. Crazy Eddie will not ever be undersold.
How much could it possibly cost if he's only got two stores? So I said, I'll bet if I do an album and I go on TV,
right,
because radio is too expensive,
right,
and radio only plays music. They don't see your face.
Right.
You know, there's no movement, you know. So I said, it's got to be TV. I'm going to go on TV and I'm going to do a commercial and I'm going to find out if people love me or not.
Uh-huh.
If I lose, if I swing and I miss the ball, I can handle it. But I can't quit before I get my chance. Because I think people are going to like me. Because
uh-huh.
I'm sincere and I'm a good singer and I think they're going to like me. So I start doing research and I find out that you can buy TV spots. Now, at the time, there were no credit cards, no 800 numbers.
Right.
But there was... six stations only.
Uh-huh.
Channel 2 was CBS, Channel 4 was NBC, Channel 5 was NEW, 7 was ABC.
Correct.
And there was WOR on Channel 9 and correct. WPIX on Channel 11.
Right, the Yankees. Gotcha.
All right, now, in those days there were no remote controls, so people watched commercials.
Right.
Because there were no fast forward, and people were too goddamn lazy to get up and change the channel during the commercial.
Right.
So commercials worked. So I said, I'm going to go on TV, and I'm going to do an album, make a commercial. I'm going to go on TV, and I'm going to find out if people like me or not.
Uh-huh.
And if they don't, I'll quit. But if they do, I'll have a career.
Right.
So for a whole year, I do research, and I find out that buying TV time in the New York market, which covered 20 million people,
right,
45-mile radius, which meant 90 miles in diameter,
right,
from half of Jersey, all of New York City, all of Long Island, all of Connecticut, or most of Connecticut.
Right, Staten
and
Island.
A lot of upstate, you know, right, a lot of upstate, and some Pennsylvania.
Right.
20 million people. So I said, I'm going to do this. So I go to Lee Solomon, who's the president of William Morris.
Right.
And I tell him my idea. And I can't curse on the air, so... I'll just tell you, he said I was nuts.
Okay.
I won't tell you the adjective he used before that.
All right.
So I said, why am I nuts? He said, you can't go on. He said, you're unknown.
Right.
He said, you can't sell a record if you're unknown. I said, Lee, if I go on 100 times a week, how long will it take before I'm not unknown?
Right.
Won't people relate me to my own commercial? People know who squeezes the Charmin, for Christ's sake.
Right, or Mr. Clean. I mean, you know.
Right. If you can't tell me if I go on 100 times a week, they're not going to relate me to my own commercial.
Right.
He said, Peter, it's never been done. I said, that's the point.
Uh-huh.
It's never been done. So won't that be an advantage? He said, no, you're crazy. I said, well, he said, all singers are crazy. I said, okay. All right. So I find out you can buy spots in New York for $100 a piece.
Wow.
So that means that I could buy, if you're buying a block of 100 spots,
uh-huh,
and you can buy them across the board.
Right.
And it's not really that much. You know, people used to tell me, every time I turned the TV on, you were there. Well, the truth is, 100 spots divided over six stations.
Right.
There's only seven spots a day.
But that's a lot.
You know, or eight spots a day. But it is a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I worked for 3 years to raise the money.
Wow.
Nobody thought it was possible, so I couldn't get, and now finally I end up was with seven guys who had no life at all.
Hmm.
I mean, they were wealthy, they had a Midas muffler shop, they had they were doctors, they were, you know, they had other businesses, but they had no fun in their lives. And I realized that the reason they weren't putting up the money is because you know, as far as making money, they already had a lot of money.
Right.
So they weren't interested in making money. So I said to them, you get on board with me, we'll go to Vegas, you'll have the time of your life. And that's why they invested in me. But they still didn't think I could do it because they had never seen me in the star setting. All they ever saw me is in the restaurant bragging about myself. So I rented the Westboro Music Fair.
Right.
And I invited all of them. And I went on radio to sell, you know, sell the advertising.
Right.
And it cost me $12,000 to rent the place, to rent, you know, to hire the band, to advertise. And oddly enough, we drew 2,000 people.
All right.
The craziest out of 2,800. So the place looked full.
Right.
And I made a big fuss out of each one of them.
Uh-huh.
Then I invited the entire audience to the Seascape in Islip as my guest.
Wow.
And the friend of mine who was a banker who was trying to help me do this, he said to me, how the hell can you invite the whole audience? I said, they're not all going to come.
Right.
The place holds 200.
Right.
So maybe it's going to cost me $2,000 to feed everybody.
Okay.
But 2,000 people aren't going to get in.
Right.
So it worked. It all worked. Right. Instantly they put up the money.
Uh-huh.
So then I meet Teddy Randazzo.
Oh.
And he comes up with the greatest songs I've ever heard in my life. And we make an album.
Right.
And then I do a live album that was recorded from Westbury. And we made a 2-album package to make it even better. And I come up with $60,000 to buy 6 weeks of 100 spots a week.
Wow.
Now here's the part, Mike, that I'm going to be very honest about.
Go ahead.
I never thought we'd sell a record. You know, you got to be honest, you know, in retrospect and say, what were you thinking?
You were shitting bullets.
You know, I kept doing the math on a calculator.
Right.
If we could sell enough records to stay on the air, I got to become famous, I'm going to have a career.
Right.
But I never really thought we would sell records.
Uh-huh.
Never in a million years did I think we'd sell 1,800,000 records. Never. Well, what happened was, because it had never been done, and because the commercial was really good, and the songs were good, and what they saw on the commercial they liked.
Songs were great.
Thank you. Well, it went on the air on a Friday, January 15th, 1976. By Monday, my life had changed. And this is the funny part. I'm living on a circle in Islip with 41 houses.
Uh-huh.
I'd already been on The Tonight Show twice, and 2 or 3 Mike Douglases, and 1 Merv Griffin. And nobody knew who I was.
Uh-huh.
From Friday to Monday, the entire 41 houses went nuts. Couldn't believe that I lived on the same block that they did.
Uh-huh.
And before you know, after 16 weeks, I could not walk on the street.
Wow.
I mean, if I went to the supermarket, they went crazy. If I went to a gas station, I caused trouble. It was just unbelievable. The power of television.
Well, I remember seeing the commercial all day long, every day, every night. I mean, you know, I mean, everybody who lived in the tri-state area knew that commercial and knew the lyrics to both of the big tunes.
You
are about to witness a new dimension in entertainment. Peter Lemongello.
Oh, I could have been a million things.
Peter Lemongello, a mood rock experience called Love 76. Yes, Peter Lemongello has created a new kind of music that's both romantic and moving. Just listen.
Come closer, baby.
In this 2-album package, Love 76, you'll experience all the warmth and tenderness living in the heart of Peter Lemongello, plus the excitement that is Peter Lemongello on stage.
But I can't get you off my mind. No matter what I do, I just can't get you off my mind. No matter how I try, I just can't. Do I love you? Don't you know my love?
you hear Love 76, you'll fall in love with Mood Rock and a man named Peter Lemongello. Hear him every day. Here's how. To order Love 76, call 586-7700. That's 586-7700. Or save COD charges and send $6.98 for records or $8.98 for 8-track tape to Love 76, Box R7, Gracie Station, New York, New York, 128.
It's really amazing.
Truth?
Really an amazing situation. And I know they still teach it in marketing classes in colleges today. And people say that it was the forerunner for MTV and the infomercial. And the funny part of it is, when we filmed the commercial, the guy filming it was really good.
Uh-huh.
But he said to me during that time, give me the song titles because I want to create a crawl, which is a thing they do in front of, this, you know, where they show the song titles, they
right.
come up in the bottom of the screen,
right.
and it crawls up the screen.
Right.
And I said, we're not going to do that. And he said, why? I said, I'm an unknown singer.
Uh-huh.
You're going to put unknown song titles in front of my face?
Right.
I've got 1 minute to sell myself to the
exactly.
people. Do you really think I want to block it with unknown song titles?
Right. You want them to see the puppy dog eyes and the expression and the body language.
I just want to sing on camera and hope they like me.
Yeah, I hear you.
And that was my hope. That was my whole ambition. And again, sell enough records to stay on, because I didn't think 6 weeks was going to make me famous.
Right.
I thought if we could stay on for 10 or 12 weeks, it might.
Right.
And God, it was just an unbelievable experience. When I could sell Madison Square Garden out in 3 hours.
Wow.
Nobody was more shocked than me. I mean, you know, that's really comical, but the truth is, when you're recording those songs, and Teddy wrote great songs.
Right.
You know, he wrote Going Out of My Head and Hurt
right.
So Bad.
You bet.
Big hits. The songs he gave me were all disco songs, and we created a thing called Mood Rock.
Right.
And the funniest part of it is, when I was in the studio recording those songs, like any other singer, I said to myself, I wonder if anybody will ever hear this.
Yeah.
You know, it's really comical, but that's the way we think when we're honest about, you know, our inner feelings. You know, and yet, actually everybody in my family called me and said, my God, this is unbelievable. Everywhere I go, everybody knows who I am because my name is Lemongello.
And at this time, I think your brother was on TV bowling at this particular time, too, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, but at that time, he won the U.S. Open.
Right.
He became the first Italian inducted into the Hall of Fame.
I remember.
But nobody related him to me.
Right.
Until I went on TV and did that commercial.
Well, also,
all of us, prior to that, I was Mikey's brother.
Yeah, but you know what? Also, the name is so damn catchy, you know, because it's fun to say Lemongello. People, you know, people had fun with that as well, because there were no singers that were Lemongello, you know, because
that's so funny.
It creates.
I gotta say, that's a funny statement, because the first manager I ever had
right.
changed my name from Peter Lemongello to Johnny Barron.
Nah.
You know, Bobby Darin, Johnny Barron.
Yeah.
You know?
Nah.
So, when I got rid of him, the next manager I had said, what's your name? You know, maybe we can elaborate on it.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Lemongello. He did a double take, and he said, no, don't change it at all.
Of course not.
He said, that'll work.
You bet it.
So
it was. I can't tell you, and I'm sure you've heard this, how many people have said, oh, I'll tell you the story about Peter Lemongello, man. He was a friend of mine growing up. I can't, you know how people, you know, it's like once they start talking, they can't stop. Oh man, he was a friend of mine, man. He was mob backed. Come on, the mafia was behind him. You know that, man. These guys,
okay.
Nobody could pull that off unless they had the mob behind. I heard that 1,000 times.
Of course, you cannot have an Italian name coming out of New York, getting famous, and not have everybody think the mob backed you.
Right.
It's just the way it is in America. I mean, this is the funniest story I can tell you is that my mother asked me to go make a bank deposit for her.
Uh-huh.
And in North Babylon.
Right.
And I'm so famous at the time, I cannot walk the streets.
Uh-huh.
So I walk into the bank, and everybody's staring at me. And a lady says to me, and you know, I hate to use the word gavone, but she was one.
Okay.
and she said, they're really pushing you. And I said, who are they? Uh-huh. And she goes, you know who I mean. And I said, she goes, it didn't hurt having your mother own that big record company in Copay.
Right.
So I said, that is the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Right.
My father died of cancer when I was 9.
Right.
My mother got a job in Copay called, in a place called Visi Record, short for Visible Records.
Okay.
They make filing cabinets. Now, do you really think there's a big record company in Copay?
No.
I don't know how you conjured that up, but that is the most, maybe it's not the most ridiculous story I ever heard, but it's certainly in the top three.
Yeah, but you know what? People, and look, you know, how people will come over to you and whatever. And what's funny about it is you don't know who they are, but they certainly know who you are. And so they want you to know who they are. And in other words, you know, their fantasy is that you do know who they are. So, you know, and they make up a little saga in their minds about what it's all about, you know.
Hey, there's nothing more comical than reality.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I'm in show business for now over 40 years.
Right.
And I'm doing the West Bend Music Fair in 2010.
Uh-huh.
And they call it the triumphant return and all that.
All right.
I get an email from a guy that said, I saw you in 1975, which is wrong. He saw me in 76.
Right.
He said, do you remember me? Christ, there's 2,800 people in the audience. Do you think I memorized the whole audience?
Right. Yes, he.
But that's what they say.
Right.
Or even today, they come up to me and say, I know how you made it. I know the mafia back to you. And
right.
I say, really? Did you really think just because my name ended in an O
right.
that I was the latest mafia candidate for stardom?
Right.
Well, let me ask you a question. Has anybody ever gone on TV since me and launched a career on TV?
Right.
So if the mafia did it, why wouldn't they do it again?
Right.
You know, so, you know, I really think that's funny, and I don't get offended by it, but I do in one way. If my name was Tom Jones,
right.
they would never insinuate it was mafia,
uh-huh.
or Engelbert Humperdinck.
Right.
They would never insinuate, because
right.
they don't make the connection. But if you're Tony Bennett, Jerry Vale, Frank Sinatra,
right.
Peter Lemongello,
yeah.
automatically they do.
No, I
and that's just the way it is.
I
you know, when I was in Branson, Missouri for 3 years,
right.
people would come up to me who had become friends, and they would say, boy, I had a problem this week with a guy who was going to ask you to get some of your boys to take care of it. I said, are you kidding? Do you really think I have a crew? You know, I mean, you really think I'm a part of Goodfellas?
Hey, listen, we did Branson when I was with the Mystics and all of that, and it's a very interesting place, because sitting in one of those theaters, you have CEOs of corporations that are on vacation that go to see the acts, and then right next to them are the guys that came down the hills from the Ozarks that have no teeth and have license plate on their house, and it's like all one big mix, and they're all sitting shoulder to shoulder, but it's like two different groups of people. It's amazing.
It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. I can tell you that of all the places I've ever performed in, that is the most unique place I've ever worked.
Oh, yeah.
People are in the audience who have never seen a live show. You know, they're coming coveralls. I mean, they're Harry Hayseeds. They're from the Ozarks. They're
right.
from Kansas and Oklahoma, but they've never seen a live show. So, honestly, the fact that they like you doesn't mean anything, because they're so thrilled to see a live show. You know, it's really not that big a feather in your cap.
There's a lot of talent in Branson. I mean, they have these reviews, you know, where they come out and they do 50s and 40s and whatever. And some of these kids are like, they don't even realize how good they are.
Well, the joke about Branson is this.
Uh-huh.
What's the difference between Branson and Jurassic Park?
What?
The truth is, the answer is, one is a theme park for dinosaurs,
uh-huh.
and the other one's a movie, I think.
Right. There you go.
Because
yeah.
most of the people in Branson, Missouri
uh-huh.
are people that had no place else to go.
Uh-huh.
But the truth is that they found a home there.
Uh-huh.
And it was wonderful. It's not exactly the same today. A lot of the big names have left.
I know. Well,
you know, there are, when I was there, Bobby Vick was there, Tony Orlando, and Andy Williams. There were a lot of pop acts there.
Right.
Aside from Mickey Gilley and Mel Tillis and the other acts.
Right.
That were Automatic and what was the other guy that did so well there? I can't think of his name.
Yeah.
But there were so many diversified acts there.
Right.
And today, a lot of those pop acts are not there anymore. So it's more of a country mixture now.
Yeah, I think John Davidson was there for a while, and a whole bunch of people. Yeah.
I really like him. I got to know him very well when I was there.
Yeah, my wife knew him. You know, my wife had...
I just remembered Roy Clark was there.
Yeah, Roy Clark had his own place, and talented guy, Roy Clark, boy.
Extremely. Yeah, and a real sweetheart, real nice guy.
Yeah, no, that's great. Now, all right, so going back, and of course... You were with Private Stock Records, and they went bust right out from under you, which happened to so many other people. You know, I remember when Rupert Holmes had the Pina Colada tune and Infinity went out from under him with the number one record. So it happened.
Well, if there was ever a bad break in my career, it was Private Stock Records, because when I was at the height of my fame and success on TV, Larry Utah, the president of Private Stock, came to Lincoln Center, saw me, flipped over me, and wanted to sign me.
Right.
At the time, they were really burning up the street. They got hit records for David Soul and everybody. I mean, they got a hit record for my piano player, Walter Murphy.
Uh-huh.
He was my piano player at Lincoln Center and Westbury, Madison Square Garden, and he got a hit record on a Fifth of Beethoven.
Right, I
remember. So when I signed with them, I really believe the chance of me getting a hit record with them was excellent.
Right.
And within a couple of months, the whole company fell apart. A couple of the key players there, Irv Beagle and another guy, I can't think of his name
right now,
No Love, excuse me.
Uh-huh.
They were the reason that they were getting hit records, because they were just great promoters. They got lured to Arista Records, so they dropped out, and within a few months, the company went broke.
Yeah.
So that was technically the worst break I ever had.
But I
don't like to complain because, you know, things happen. Things happen that are great, that, you know, you're at the right place at the right time, and you get breaks.
Right.
And there are times when things, you know, go wrong. For example, this is a great story.
Go ahead.
I meet a guy going in. I'm walking into Private Stock Records right after I signed with them. We're planning an album, and I wanted to talk to Larry Utah about the material he had been receiving.
Right.
And I meet a guy in the hallway, just out of the elevator, and he goes, Peter Lemongello, God, I really wanted to work with you. I have a song I think you would get a mega hit on, but Larry Utah didn't like it, and he passed on it. So I said, I'm really sorry. I said, I wish I could hear it. What's the name of the song? He said, After the Lovin'. He brought it to Engelbert Humperdinck at Epic Records, and that was the last hit that Engelbert ever had.
Wow.
But he had offered it to me first. So it was a bad break in the sense that I never had the chance to do it, but the fact is that I'd never heard the song until Engelbert recorded it and I heard it on the radio.
Wow.
So I really don't know. I mean, fate was that I wasn't supposed to get it. And I really don't know if I would have loved it or hated it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, every singer has passed on terrific hits.
You bet, yeah.
You know, from me to Sinatra. So, you know, I'm not saying that if I'd have heard it, I would have loved it and recorded it and it would have been a mega hit for me. But it's just one of those things. Everybody has stories like that.
Didn't, if I remember correctly, I think My Eyes Adored You was Private Stock's first hit.
Yes, with Frankie Valli.
Yeah, because nobody would take the tune, and I think Private Stock says, give it to
and
us.
And Frankie, this is a great story. Frankie could not get arrested.
Right. I know.
He could not get arrested. Private Stock took him, they got the hit, and his career rejuvenated. Yeah, and that happens to all of us.
Yeah, I mean, I know.
You know, So the fact that Frankie has had a brilliant career, at that particular time, 1976 is what we're talking about, his type of music had faded.
Right.
And he couldn't get a record deal, and he just couldn't get anything going. So the fact that he rejuvenated his career through Private Stock is wonderful. But if it had not been for that particular situation, there might not be a Jersey Boys today.
Yeah, no, I understand that. Now, let me ask you this. Who were some of your vocal coaches over the years?
Well, I studied with a guy. That's a great story, too. I studied with a guy named Marty Lawrence.
Oh, I know who that is, sure.
Did he really? Yeah. He was just great.
I thought you were going to say Jerry Bragan or Carlo Minotti.
No, Carlo Minotti was another great one at the time of Manhattan in 1968 when I was taking voice lessons.
Yeah.
But Marty Lawrence taught me how to open up, how to save my voice. I could sing all night and never get tired.
Right.
I never get hoarse and all of that. So he really gave me what I needed.
Right.
No voice coach can give you style.
Right.
And no voice coach can make you a star, although they all try to suck you in.
Right.
And you know, tell you, if you keep taking lessons, when I think you're ready, I'm going to recommend you to some important people.
Yeah.
But that part is BS. But I did gain terrific insight as to how to control my voice and how to use it. And that's why I laugh at people today, you know, singers that I know now, that every time they're singing, they offer a disclaimer. They say, well, I've got a sore throat, and I've got this, and I've got that. I never make excuses because I don't have to.
Right.
But the real truth is that voice lessons are essential to teach you the fundamentals, how to open up, how to split vowels so they can stay open on a very difficult note, like the word my.
Right.
If you separate it to my and I, you can hold it forever.
Right.
As long as you're staying on the MA and not hitting the art.
Right, but, and always.
You know,
and,
once
and,
you know all of that, once you know all of that,
it
makes you a much better singer. But the truth is that very few people study.
Yeah, I know. I mean, Chevy Chase was doing Peter Lemon Mood Ring. I remember that.
That was incredible. You know, and at the time I was so busy, I was so in demand. Now, I wasn't home on Saturday nights watching Saturday Night Live, and there were no VCRs, so I didn't tape anything.
Right.
And I was at Studio 54, but really hot at the time.
Well, you know, I used to hang out at Soundworks Studio next door, Alan Raymer's studio, and we used to go down in the basement, whatever, and come up in Studio 54 through the basement, and that's how we used to get in.
And here's how I found out about it.
Uh-huh.
I'm really good friends with Telly Savalas.
Uh-huh.
So we're at the bar having a drink, and because we have been on a Tonight Show together.
Well, I went to Herrick's, and he was a teacher at Garden City High School, but go ahead.
You're kidding.
No, he taught at Garden City High School when he started.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, and who else we were with was Sylvester Stallone.
Uh-huh.
And Sylvester Stallone said to me, when Telly said, this is my friend, he says, he's just burning up the street, Peter Lemongello. He goes, oh, Peter Lemongello, mood ring. So he had seen the thing on Saturday Night Live. Both really wonderful guys. But I have to tell you that at that point in my life, had changed so much, I wasn't home watching TV.
I'm surprised they didn't ask you to be a guest on Saturday Night Live eventually.
Well, you know, it's funny. I thought Lorne Michaels would, but for some reason he didn't. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer to that. But I think Saturday Night Live only did things in a comical way at that time.
Right.
And, you know, having me on, they would have had to spotlight me as a straight singer. I don't think they were after that. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's really funny is Kenny Vance was the musical director for many, many years on Saturday Night Live. Believe it
or not. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's what he did after he left the Americans. He did the American Hot Wax movie, which he starred Jay Leno in that movie. And then he was the musical director for Saturday Night Live. The famous story about that is that they were supposed to go to commercial and they had James Brown on, and James Brown decided that he was going to stretch a tune with the Flames out from 3 minutes to 5 minutes, and he wouldn't get off, and they couldn't go to commercial. You know? But he was James Brown, so I guess they ate it. you know.
Hi, this is Kenny Vance from Kenny Vance and the Planetones, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
You know, it's funny. There's so many stories that I could tell. For example, I went into a bar in Jersey one night when I was pretty hot at the time, and they made a big fuss over me. And the guy singing in the band did "Do I Love You."
Ah.
And turns out it was Joe Pesci.
Oh, yeah, because Joe was a pretty good singer.
Yeah, he was a really good singer.
Yeah.
And when I walked in, he said, "Look who's here, Peter Lamangello." So he does "Do I Love You." And, you know, we all talked, and, you know, we said hello, we had a couple of drinks together. And a few years later, you know what happened to him, so.
Yep.
He started out as a hairdresser.
Yep.
Worked in a place called the Point After.
Ah.
In Bergen County. And ended up getting a spot in the first movie he ever did was Easy Money with Rodney Dangerfield.
Well, he did a little work with Joey Dean and the Starlighters for a while, you know, because they, of course, yeah, they were a Jersey Passaic group. You know, well, Shirley and the Shirelles and Joey D and the Starlighters all went to Passaic High School. They all went to the same high school. But Joey always seemed to be there. You know, he was there with the Four Seasons lurking, and he was there, I guess he made it his business to be in the right place at the right time, you know?
I don't think any actor ever played a psychotic better than he does.
You know why?
No.
Because that's his basic personality. I've spoken to him. As a matter of fact, we both have the same money manager. He when you talk to him on the phone, that's exactly the way he talks.
Exactly. So maybe he wasn't acting.
He's just playing himself.
Yeah.
I mean, the scene from Goodfellas, I mean, you know, forget about it, man. That scene, that's immortal.
I know, where he turns from happy to psychotic.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's priceless. I'm surprised he didn't get an Academy Award for that.
Now, I was lucky because I was a student for a while, and then I drew a really nice number in the lottery when the lottery came out.
Really?
Yeah, I drew like a 327 in the lottery, and they never took me. But I did go for a pre-induction physical when my student deferment ran out, and that's another long story. We went to Fort Hamilton, and that's a radio show in itself. That whole story.
Well, I can't tell you how difficult it is to be young and healthy. And to get a pre-induction draft notice where they give you a physical. And if you're healthy, you're going.
Right.
And I went right before they started the lottery.
Wow.
And to be honest with you, my father was in World War II and uncles were in Korea.
Right.
And I just assumed that it was something I had to do because that's what everybody else did. I really didn't book about it. I didn't like it at all.
Right.
And I had some terrible experiences, I just really thought that's what I was supposed to do. As an American, you know, I really thought I was supposed to do it. And I was very fortunate I wasn't injured.
Right.
When I talked to my brother today, I said, you know, when I came home from Vietnam, I was really crazy. He said, you still are.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
But,
who knows better than
the alternative? The alternative was 3 years in Leavenworth, and I wasn't going to go to Canada.
But, yeah, no, so, I know.
I really didn't give it a thought. I didn't like it at all, but I answered the call because I thought I was supposed to do it.
I have friends that were stationed in Canada. You know, it's like...
Well, I can really understand why some of them did go to Canada now.
Yeah.
I can even understand that Muhammad Ali saying no.
Yeah.
Because they were never treated fairly here.
Right.
Why should they fight for the country, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can rationalize it now. Of course, then I couldn't.
Right.
Don't forget, I was 19, you know, and I was naive compared to the way I am now.
I know. But, you know, let me tell you, you see, you're a guy who... I mean, you've done TV, you did The Tonight Show, The Dinah Shore Show, The Mike Douglas Show, you were on all the network TV shows. I mean, and you sang at places that, you know, the biggies sang, you know, Carnegie Hall and Town Center and yada yada, you know. And so the stuff that you've tasted has been, you know, phenomenal in your career. And now here you are for the baby boomers, you know. I do a show with Kenny Brady, who's the lead singer for the Casinos. We call it Doo-Wop Stylings by Mike Miller and Ken Brady. And of course, we're coming up, we're going to do the Century Villages coming up in a couple of months. I call it the oil painting, you know. It's
well,
like,
please let me know, because I want to come and see you.
Oh, absolutely. I don't go out like looking for it, of course. You know, when I married Paulette, here's the story. When I married Paulette and I was singing with the Mystic Group, I left because it wasn't good to be running to Boston and Philly and Baltimore and here and there when you have a brand new marriage, because my wife used to say to me, you know, we're flying out on a Friday afternoon, we get there, we schmooze, you know, how many times can you stick your head up Larry Chance's, you know, whatever, and he up, and then you, we eat, and then we wake up early in a sound check all day, and then you do the thing, and then you sign autographs, and then you eat. It's like two in the morning. We eat, then we get up. It's Sunday morning, so you eat the big buffet. We don't fly out till 11 or 12. We get home at 6 o'clock at night. So you've given up Friday, Saturday, and destroyed Sunday, and then you're tired Monday just to do like your 35 minutes. You know, in an oldie show that you've been doing all your life anyway, it's like, what is that all about? And of course, I would never stay in the, you know, the Fleabag Hotel, you know, wherever it was, Paulette and I stayed at the Ritz, you know, so, you know, cause I would never do that to her. So the point is, you know, it became like, okay, you're right. That's enough of this. But then I started the radio show 6 years ago, and I've interviewed probably everybody on the planet, you know. And then, you know, I said to myself, well, I got to be singing again, because that's what I enjoy doing the most, you know.
Yeah, I can't explain it either, but yeah. I can tell you this. If my back hurts,
yeah,
or if I have anything that's bothering me,
yep.
The minute they announce my name, I go out and do my show.
Yep.
Nothing hurts.
Yep, adrenaline.
And then when I get off, it hurts again.
More. But I know, because, you know, lately, there's a lot going on. Lately I've been getting these headaches and everything in. And, you know, I go to sing and it's like my head hurts and whatever. And I'm saying, oh, shit. You know, it's like I got to open up again. I had a little surgery a couple of months ago, so I wasn't singing. I wasn't working out. But you know what? Okay, so now I'm starting to sing again, and Kenny's coming down. We're going to get this show back together. And you know what? I'm going to do it, you know, in any capacity. Because to me, and I always said this, because I've been lucky. You know, I had my Harmony Street group with the three girls and the two guys. We were the entertainment for Bill and Hillary at the 98 Christmas party. That was great. And, you know, I've done the anthem at Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium and for the Knicks and the Miami Heat and, you know, for the Orioles and whatever, you know, and I've done some big things and little things, you know, but.
I always tell people, I sang the national anthem at Shea Stadium.
Uh-huh.
It was Jacket Day.
Uh-huh.
And then a week later, I did it at Yankee Stadium. Uh-huh. It was free handgun night.
Right. I know, but...
If anybody could relate to the difference between Queens and the Bronx,
yeah,
they would appreciate that.
You know, but I always say, you know, it's like, it's all about being creative. And I don't care if you're singing in front of, like, 10,000 people, or if you're singing in your living room to, like, 5 people... It's all about being in the middle of a song and having people appreciate it. It doesn't matter where you're doing it. It's about that moment.
There's nothing like doing a song where you're controlling the audience.
Yeah.
There is absolutely nothing like it. For that reason, I'll do it till I die.
Right.
And I have to tell you that you have to feel like you're the luckiest guy in the world.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And, you know, but you see, you're in the world of the baby boomers, and a lot of them are from the tri-state area. And when you say Peter Limoncello, they smile, you see, because, look, I have seen you in an awful lot of places. You know, we go to concerts and we sit next to each other and we go to places and I see you here and I see you there and whatever. And, you know, the people that come from the Tri-State area, New York and the Eastern Seaboard or whatever, it's like I just said, you know, 3 minutes ago, Peter Lemangelo makes them smile because, you know, it's like they really took to you in a wonderful way and adopted you, you know. And
well,
still,
that's really nice of you.
Well, but it's true. I mean, you know, I was thrilled when I'm trying to figure out when I ran into you or I saw you actually walk into the room the first time. It had to be like 3 or 4 years ago at one of the concerts and everything. And I said to my wife, I says, honey, you know, she's from Maryland. I says, honey, that's Peter Lemangelo. She said, well, who? And then I said, you know, Peter Lemangelo, you remember, you know, the commercial is that? Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, you know, he was the guy that sold the records on TV. Yeah, okay. But, you know, people know, you know. How, in your eyes, has the business changed since you were a young guy in a jumpsuit, you know?
The answer to that is two things. First of all, as time went by,
right,
I became more appreciative of every opportunity I got.
Uh-huh.
When I was standing on stage, they were throwing everything they had at me.
Right.
And they were screaming during the songs that I wanted them to listen to.
Right.
I was a little resentful because they weren't listening to me. They were just screaming. And now, I really enjoy the fact that they listen to what I'm doing.
Uh-huh. Oh.
So it's really more gratifying today than it was then.
Oh.
However, there are two words that coincide with growing older,
right?
And that's so what.
Yeah.
And the truth is that the fact that they don't scream anymore, they appreciate me, but it's not a sexual thing where they scream at somebody they've seen on TV and they just want to go nuts for it.
Right.
That's very acceptable to me.
Right.
Because I really appreciate the fact that they enjoy what I'm doing now.
Uh-huh.
So it's a totally different type of appreciation. However, I must tell you that I'm getting more out of the audience than I ever got.
Uh-huh.
There was a time when I performed because really I had to.
Right.
And I really didn't care what they thought because I wasn't, you know, grateful of the fact that I'd gotten famous and they enjoyed what I was doing.
Right.
Now, it's a situation where I get the biggest kick out of controlling the audience.
Right.
I can make them laugh. I can bring them up. I can bring them down.
Right.
And that's really more gratifying than the fame was. Fame is a funny thing. You really seek it when you don't have it.
Uh-huh.
But when you get it, it really isn't as important as you thought it was.
Right.
And I guess every accomplishment crumbles in your grasp.
Right.
You know, you want to be recognized because the worst thing in the world is to be an unknown.
Well, it's nice when you're minding your own business and you walk into a Publix in a different neighborhood and somebody comes over and goes, you're Peter Lemangelo, aren't you? It's got to make you feel good.
Well, it does, and it's gratifying. And I really appreciate it. But I appreciate it more now than I did then.
Yeah, no, I
expected it then.
Right.
But, you know, I would go to a movie and anybody's familiar with a movie house in Nassau County, there are 150, 200 people standing in the lobby waiting to get in.
Right.
Waiting for the last show. And causing a stir at that time was important.
Right.
But now, when people recognize me, it's a totally different feeling.
Yeah.
It's really something that I appreciate.
I got you.
It's a totally different feeling. It's really like a year ago, I went to a Don Rickles show, and I hadn't worked with him in 40 years.
Right.
And when he saw me, He said, Peter, my God, we were so close. Don't forget, I opened for him for 2 years.
Right.
And he said, my God, it's good to see you.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a different kind of appreciation. It really is. It's totally more gratifying today than it was then.
I was sad. We went to see Joan Rivers and Don Rickles at the Kravis Center 2 years ago. And Joan got out there and she says, look at this fucking band behind me. It's 27 pieces. I don't sing one song. Don Rickles sings a song and a half, and I had to pay for half of this band. So it was funny. You know, she was funny. And he got out there and he told a couple of, and he was really roaring at the beginning. All of a sudden, something came over him and he lost it. And he started to tell a joke that he had told like 5 minutes before. And he gets halfway through the joke, and finally he says, oh, I told that joke already. Geez, I'm sorry, whatever. And he became a little disoriented. And it was sad to see, you know. And then he, you know how when he likes to invite a couple on stage and he picks them apart? Well, he decides he's going to have a couple in the first row come up. But if in a Kravis Center, you got to walk all the way down, then you got to walk all the way across, then you walk, the stairs are on only on one side. It took them a minute and a half to get up there. During that time, it's pretty much dead time and whatever. And he kind of lost the crowd, and people started to leave. And he's got the mic, and he's going, I hope you can't find your fucking car. I mean, you know, Paulette and I looked at each other and we said, you know, it's terrible to see him like this because, you remember him being able to take the entire room apart and then put it back together piece by piece, you know.
Well, I hate to see somebody. Now, for example, my manager today is Elliot Wiseman.
Okay.
Who manages Don Rickles.
Right.
And I often say to him, why is Don still working?
Right. He don't have to.
You know, he certainly doesn't need the money.
Right.
So what is he doing out there looking so feeble and disoriented?
Right.
He said, you know what it is? He can't quit.
Right.
He can't stop getting that feedback from the audience.
Right.
And the audience is only there because they want to see him before he dies.
No, I know. I mean, Shecky Green said to me, he says, he's 84. He says, I do one show a year, two shows a year. He says, I can't remember the damn jokes. I can't remember them. You know?
Well, you know, I think there's a certain element of truth in saying that they should know when to quit.
Right.
You know, Don was the best I've ever seen.
Right.
I mean, I worked with him night after night, and he was so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gone now. He doesn't have that same capability.
Right, no, I know.
And technically, I don't understand why he keeps working.
Well, probably for that same reason. I mean, I remember Buddy Hackett off stage when he used to do the Catskills, and he was like the nastiest mother. I mean, the way he would talk to people all the time, people would say, oh, he's kidding. And the point is, no, he wasn't.
he wasn't.
He had a nasty edge.
Don is the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah, I know. That's the opposite.
Buddy was not nice.
I know that.
To anybody.
Yeah, I know. Let me ask you this. Who's your favorite singer?
Technically, my favorite singer is a guy who, you're not going to believe this answer. Victor Moe.
You know what? Always my best choice. I actually got in touch with him some months ago and asked him if he wanted to be on the show, and he said he wasn't up to it. That he wasn't.
Vic and I were really good friends. We were both managed by Joe Scandori.
That is my choice as well. The best pipes.
Vic was probably the best singer that ever lived.
Right.
He is just the best technician that ever lived. Problem is, he had no personality at all.
Yeah.
And it really went against him because he was really boring when he shouldn't have been.
Well, no, I understand.
You know, he just missed the boat in the respect of being a regular guy.
I hear you. Well, you know, Johnny Mathis doesn't exude too much either. And
well, Johnny is different totally. Johnny is an album.
Right. You
he
bet.
Stands on stage. He doesn't move. He just sings. But he's gifted with an incredible voice. And he just does an album on stage. And people love it.
I got a story. You know, I interviewed him. And he just opened up like a flower. And he was so gracious. And we went to the Kravis Center. And he invited us backstage. And he kissed me on both cheeks. And Paulette and whatever. And it, to me, it was like, be still my heart. Johnny Mathis, you know, my hero. And you know, he was so gracious, and during the whole show you could hear a pin drop. And of course, you know, Paul Vance wrote like 15 tunes, and Paul was supposed to go with us, and the last minute he says, nah, I'm not gonna go. Tell him I said hello, yada yada yada. But I got one of those about 2 years later, I got one of those emails, you know, that I've been kidnapped in the Philippines and I need money. You know, they hacked my Yahoo account. I'm sure you did. Yeah. And I get a call. I'm with my father-in-law, and we're getting his tires put on his Buick. And I get a phone call, and I look down, and it's an 801 area code. And I'm saying, who the hell's calling me from California? I hit the button, and it says, Mike? Yeah. John Mathis. I said, yeah? He goes to me, are you okay? Do you need money? He says, I got this email that you needed money and you were kidnapped or whatever. He says, now, do you need money? I said, no, my thing was hacked and everything else. But here's Johnny Mathis calling me to ask me if I'm okay. And I'm saying to myself, geez, what a human interest story. What a guy. All I did was I interviewed him for 2.5 hours, you know, and I told him, you know, how when I used to go to my singing gigs, I used to put on Johnny's greatest hits and warm up on the way there. Yeah, you know.
Well, that is a lesson in stardom.
Right.
When I was going to do my first Lincoln Center concert,
uh-huh.
The week before Johnny Mathis was there.
Uh-huh.
So I went to see him with my girlfriend because I wanted to, you know, look at the place and see what it was like. Because I hadn't done concert halls then.
Right.
It was my first time. So I went backstage, and he looks me right in the eye, and he goes, I love your commercials.
Oh.
And I'm saying, holy shit, Johnny Mathis knows me?
Right.
You know, and that was a real awakening for me.
Hey, Mike, John Mathis.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks. It's Johnny Mathis, and you're listening to my good friend Mike Miller on the Harmony Street Show.
And it couldn't have been nicer.
Yeah.
But the truth is that when you get famous,
right.
You find out that people who are famous know who you are. It's the biggest shock in the world.
One of my things as far as famous people, and, you know, like I said, I've interviewed just about everybody in the business at this point. Ronnie Spector used to live down the block from me in Danbury. Because of John Greenfield, I can't get her on the phone because he's like so controlling. She said to me, out of the arms of one controlling Jew and into the arms of another. And you know, and he almost spit out his chicken salad sandwich, you know, on that one. I'll give you another one. I've been on stage with Bobby Rydell a whole bunch of times, and Linda Hamilton won't let him come on my show. She says, well, you know, if it's for a specific concert or whatever, otherwise, you know, da, 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 da. And I says,
I got to tell you, Bobby's the nicest guy.
Oh, I know he is, because, you know, it's just that they protect him so well.
I know. You know. But he told me a funny story.
Uh-huh.
You know, he had all those operations, you know, he had kidney transplant and everything.
Right.
And then he calls me and he tells me, wait, you hear this? He says, I'm laying on my couch and my dog is on my lap.
Uh-huh.
And I just get out of the hospital and the dog bit me on the nose. So now I'm back in the hospital four hours later. And I have to explain that the dog bit me on the nose. He said, they really think I'm crazy.
Nah.
And he said, maybe they don't think I want to leave the hospital. But he is the sweetest guy.
Oh, I know. The one thing about Peter Lemangello that I know is that, you know, Peter Lemangello, remember that guy in the jumpsuit, you know, with the hair and, you know, really good looking guy. had a mystery about him. There was a mystery about, a mystique about Peter Lemongello, you know, and that's what a lot of people felt too. It's like, who is this guy? All of a sudden he just arrived, you know. But anyway, it's like, there you were.
The best way I can answer that is people didn't say, who is Peter Lemongello? After a few weeks of the commercial running, they actually said, who the hell is Peter? And the amazing part is, they thought that I just started. They didn't know that I had struggled for 8 years.
Yeah.
Before that commercial happened.
Yeah, all those
and
years.
That's really the mystery and the wonderment of our business.
All those years to become an overnight success, you know.
Exactly.
You know,
I was really good friends with Colbert Monica and all of the comics that I worked with, the Colbert, I worked with him at the Colbert, but I also worked with Don Rickles at the Colbert, which was like the highlight of my life because when I say everybody in show business, everybody at the Mafia, everybody was there for those 2 weeks.
Right.
In 1973. That was the most thrilling 2 weeks I ever had in my life.
What is your favorite song to sing?
Honestly, My Way.
Okay.
And the reason has nothing to do with Frank Sinatra.
Right.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friends, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I've traveled each and every highway. Oh, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byways. Oh, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew. But through it all, when there was doubt, I ate it up. Hey, I've loved, I've laughed and cried, I've had my fill, my share of losing. And now as tears subside, I find it all so amusing to think I did all that. And may I say, not in a shy way, oh no, oh no, not me, I did it my way. For what is a man, what has he got, if not himself, then he has not. to say the things he truly feels, and not the words of one who kneels. The record shows I took the blows and did it my way.
Poor Anchor, because the most comical thing in the world is that Paul Anchor once said to me, he gave me Do I Love You on the telethon.
Huh.
And I was going to do a Tonight Show that following Wednesday. And he said, what's coming up for you? I said, I'm going to do Tonight Show Wednesday. He said, I have a song for you. Do I Love You? You got to hear it.
Huh.
He sent it to me. My arranger wrote it, and we did it that Wednesday on the Tonight Show.
Wow.
It was a cerebral palsy telethon.
Wow.
On a Sunday.
Wow.
With Stephen Eady and Paul Anka.
Wow.
At the Ed Sullivan Theater. And I did it on the Tonight Show, and that caused me to raise the money.
Wow.
All right? And now, the amazing part of it is, years later I see Paul Anka and I say, Paul, thank you so much for writing that song. He's not even a writer. It was a suicide note. Just like My Way. And I said, what did you say? He said, My Way was a suicide. I didn't write it either. It was a suicide note written in France by Francois Dubois. And I just did the English translation.
Wow.
Amazing. Amazing story. And as a result of that, Frank Sinatra didn't talk to him for 10 years.
Wow.
Because he never knew that Paul didn't write that song.
Wow.
He originally thought Paul wrote the song for him.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't want to do it because he thought it was too egotistical.
Right.
And all his friends, Julie and everybody, said, Frank, it's made for you.
Right.
So the rest is history. But when he found out Paul didn't write it, he didn't talk to him for 10 years.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Incredible story.
Let's talk about something even more important than everything else we've spoken about. Tell me about that son of yours.
My son, Peter Jr., is the most amazing part of my life. I got married in 1993.
Right.
And at the time that I got married, I didn't believe in anything.
Uh-huh.
I've been married twice before.
Right.
I didn't believe in women. I didn't believe in royalty. I didn't believe in anything.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is just so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
We've had 21 years of bliss. She has made me believe in everything again.
It's like Paulette
tonight. In 1999, we had Peter Jr.
Wow.
And he is the light of my life. Although I have two other beautiful children.
Right.
Who are grown now.
Right.
Peter has made me young.
Right.
He's a great performer. He is someone that makes me feel like I live again. And it's almost as if somebody wrote a song called Carry On Old Blue Eyes.
Uh-huh.
Through your eyes, I will see forever.
Right.
He is someone that just makes me feel that life is worth it again.
Right.
And it's just an incredible situation. Whenever I see him on stage, and he is just an incredible performer, much greater than I've ever been. He can move.
Uh-huh.
He knows how to turn an audience on.
Right.
And he just makes the house stop and watch him.
Yeah.
And it's just, even if they're talking, if they're drinking, if they're trying to pick up women, it doesn't matter. They all stop and watch him. He's just incredible.
Well, you know, you take him and put him in the midst of adults in the business, and he carries his own weight in a crowd of adults, and he's got a smile and a wink, and he is electric, and you know, because how many times have I seen him at concerts and whatever, and he's sitting with you, and you'll come over and you'll introduce him to all the greats in the business, and then you'll point at him and he does his little Elvis twitch, you know, and great. And he's doing a radio show now.
It's absolutely amazing. Here's the most amazing part.
Go ahead.
He loves it more than I've ever loved it. And that's amazing. And that's so inspiring. It's so rewarding. Because, you know, we never know how long we're going to live. But the fact that he's going to carry on is so inspiring for me.
Plus, he's getting an earlier start than you did.
Oh, much earlier. Because I, you know, at his age, I had no opportunity to be on stage. He's been everywhere.
Right.
The Hilton Atlantic City Resorts in Atlantic City, Westbury Music Fair, the Garden State Arts Center, the Carl Springs Center for the Arts.
Right.
His credits are better than mine. He's 14 years old.
Lucky kid, you know.
Yeah, I know. And I'm blessed to have him, and really blessed to have Karen for a wife.
Yeah, you know, I hear you loud and clear because Paulette taught me how to live again and how to love again. When, you know, when I was just kicking around, dating most of Southern Florida, I'd come home after singing, and it was just me looking at myself in the mirror, and I had really had enough of that. I mean, I could never have been, you know, I did eulogies for most of my immediate family. I had my daughters up north, of course, but I was very much alone, and Paulette taught me a whole new way again, you know, and taught me how to open up and live again. So I understand exactly what you're saying. You know, it works. What are your plans for the future, Peter?
Well, you know, to be honest, we have dates in Atlantic City.
Right.
You know, we certainly do a lot of dates in South Florida. I really don't like traveling anymore.
Right.
So I'm really happy to pick and choose and to be in a position where I can.
Right.
And like you, I'm so grateful for my wife, Karen.
Right.
Because I've reached a point in my life where I really don't want anything else.
Right.
But I'm so grateful for what I have and the things that I've accomplished.
Right.
And I don't have the problem of seeking anything in the future. And that's a very interesting point because if nothing happens after this, I'm still satisfied.
So, Peter, I'm really looking forward to seeing you at one of your shows real soon and being in the audience and giving you the support that you deserve. And, you know, that's great. And I'm glad to have you as my neighbor and my friend. It's just a wonderful thing, Peter Lemongello in Southern Florida. You know, it's fabulous.
Well, thank you, Mike. I'm looking forward to seeing your performances. I really enjoy being your friend. And I'm so grateful that we live in the same area so we can cultivate that in the future.
Absolutely. So thanks for taking out the time to talk to me, Peter, and I will see you real soon, and have a wonderful week.
Thank you, Mike. My pleasure. I really enjoyed being with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ciao.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Shadow of a doubt, like the mighty river flows, as the meadow gaily plays with the wind on summer days, about as deep as deep can go, from the canyons to the sky. Like a mother as she cares for the baby that she bears. Do I love you? Don't you know by now? Do I love you? Must I show you how? Do I? Must I always say, do I love you? Yes, in every way. Love is sacred as a hymn and a Bible full of prayers, from a whisper to a roar, very much and even more. And I will show it
with my eyes and share it with the night. If in death the good Lord is kind, you'll be the last thing on my mind. Do I love you? Don't you know by now? Do I love you? Must I show you how? Do I love you? Must I always say? Do I love you? Yes, in every way. Do I love you? Don't you know by now? Do I love you? Must I show you how? Do I love you? Must I give your hand to me, and then you say hello, and I can hardly speak, my heart is beating so, and anyone could tell, you think you know me well, well you don't know me, no. You don't know the one who longs for you at night and longs to kiss your lips and longs to hold you tight. To you I'm just a friend, that's all I've ever been, 'cause you don't know me. I never knew the art of making love, though my heart aches with love for you. Afraid and shy, I let my chance go by, the chance you might have loved me too. You give your hand to me, then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away beside the lucky guy, to never, never know the one who loves you so. Well, you don't know me. Heartaches with love for you. I was afraid and shy, I let my chance go by, the chance you might have loved me too. You give your hand to me, then you say goodbye. I watch you walk away beside the lucky guy, oh, to never, never know the one who loves you so. Well, you don't know. know me. You'll never know who loves you so. No, you don't know me.